A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
Welcome to Silmarillion Stories. We're the Lorehounds, your guides to Tolkien's world of Middle-earth. I'm John, and this is our podcast for Of Men, the 13th portion of the Silmarillion. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the introduction of a new faction in Middle-earth. Now, if you want to get in on the Tolkien talk, send an email to lotr@thelorehounds.com or visit our website where we have a contact form or use the nifty voicemail feature. We've got a Discord server too, and you can find the link below where we have a fun and active community with a dedicated Tolkien channel and channels for all of the other shows we're covering. Now stick around to the end of the podcast for programming notes for the rest of April, like Shogun and Earthsea. One more note, if you want to support us directly, please head to patreon.com/thelorehounds or check the show notes for a link to Supercast. It's very similar and has the same pricing, but it's a little bit more geared towards podcasting. For as little as $3 a month, you can get ad-free and early access to every episode, plus access to Shireside Chats and Second Breakfast. Shireside Chats, of course, is where I will be breaking down the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien one by one. All right, so you may notice that I'm the only one in this intro today, and that's unusual because Silmarillion Stories has been a joint effort between me and David since the beginning. However, I think David is going into the West, and we are going to be... Well, okay, not into the West. He's not dead.
I hope not.
He's
not dead, yet.
But he's going to be working on some other projects, still on the Lorehound, still, you know, he's got a lot of things cooking. He's working on a lot of different programming. We're still, of course, doing the main show together and things like that and plenty of side projects. But just for this project, we are moving this into a rotating guest format. So you've already heard her voice. Guess who's with me this first time? A familiar voice. Marilyn Arpukila, our favorite Tolkien scholar. Marilyn, how you doing?
I'm fine, John, and it's great to be back, and hello, everybody. Mai gavanen.
Thanks for being here, Marilyn. It's always fun to talk Tolkien with you. So you are a Tolkien veteran, the Silmarillion veteran. We've done your intro to the Silmarillion many times.
Yeah.
Just if you want her bona fides, her email, her website is in the show notes. And I'm sure you've seen her on our Discord server chatting away about all the intricacies of Tolkien. You can also find her podcast Rings and Rituals on its own feed, and you can find that link in the show notes as well. In there, Marilyn is working with Dr. Sarah Brown, who's also on the Prancing Pony podcast, to break down The Rings of Power Season 1, one episode at a time, through the lens of ritual. Do you want to give a pitch for that, Marilyn, real quick?
Yeah, well, you've summed it up pretty well. We're having a great time and we're getting some good response, which is nice. It's nice to look at the show on its own merits. I mean, that, you know, when you have an adaptation of something as beloved as Tolkien, you're going to run into a lot of things that just focus on that. And I wanted to look at ritual because I felt it was a really important aspect of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I wanted to look at the communities that they were constructing on their own terms by looking at what are the rituals that Payne and McKay created for them.
Right.
And it's brought out a lot of really interesting stuff, actually. I mean, who knew that orcs had rituals?
Right.
So, and it's centered around the series, but we also sometimes talk about, you know, rituals in our own lives or other connections with Tolkien and so forth. And you and I did a podcast on the music, mm-hmm. which was fun. I'm still looking for someone to help me with world building and ritual as a concept. So we'll see if that happens or not.
Interesting. Well, maybe I'll hop in again.
You'd be welcome.
We'll see.
You'd be welcome.
Well, anyway, I don't know when you're putting out the, I still have to edit it, but I don't know when you're putting out the music interview. So you'll have to subscribe to her feed to get that interview, because we're not going to tell you when it's going to be in there.
Just have to, you know, watch that space.
All right. So today we're talking about of men, you know, just to start off.
This place of hope. Men. Men are weak. The race of men is failing.
Now, there's plenty of issues with that statement, and many have characterized that as a very out-of-character statement.
Indeed.
That Peter Jackson added to the movies that is not present in the books. But it's a fun quote, so I put it in anyway.
Well, I guess the women are all just fine then.
The women are all just fine. Why don't we talk about that first, before we even dive into the story?
Sure.
We talk a lot about men with Tolkien. Now, men is what Tolkien calls this whole race. That's right. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. He uses it as a inclusive noun.
Do you know why he chose to do that instead of use human?
I think it's because it's part of the type of literary tradition that he was writing in. If you think about the sagas or the Eddas or Gawain and the Green Knight, you know, all the different sources, the mythologies and so on, women just don't get featured unless they're truly exceptional. But the outer world of community was men and male in most of the stories he was reading.
Right.
And to call them men implies that it's the men who are the movers and the shakers, and this is what human beings are all about, which, you know, maybe was true, maybe wasn't true. It all depends on what you mean by quote unquote important.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly we wouldn't have a story if we didn't have Lúthien to Núvial.
Absolutely.
And there are other examples. So there are whole books written about Tolkien and women, and you'll get whole bunches of different perspectives. And they extend that to his life and claim that, you know, well, you know, he grew up with his brothers and he didn't have his mother and he didn't have any women in his life, yada, yada, until he met Edith and fell madly in love and then relegated her to, you know, home and family and whatnot.
All right.
I think that's an unnuanced look. I think there have been books more recently written by, particularly one called Perilous and Fair. And I'm blanking on the names of the editors, but it's a collection of essays that really look at this issue more closely. But I think for him, it was a literary convention. It was a social convention. I don't know if he considered human to be a more modern term. I'm not even sure that this right. kind of discussion would have been an issue even in his own lifetime. I mean, he
right.
died, what, in 73, I think, 72?
Mm-hmm.
And the women's move, the second wave, so-called, of the women's move was just getting started at that point. So,
right. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the fact that he even goes to the lengths of saying mannish instead of human when describing a woman.
That is interesting, isn't it?
It's a very interesting choice, and I'm not sure we're going to be able to rationalize it tonight.
I'm not going to try. I just call him human. That's it.
Right. But tonight we're talking about the race of men, as Tolkien calls them. I promise that we're not going to start calling women in this in the real world men, but in this podcast, the women of Tolkien's world are the race of men. They're mannish. So this is much more of a lore-based chapter than a story. And we're also, of course, told up front, men are only a small part of the story that really centers around the Noldor.
Right, right. And, you know, around elves generally, this is all very much told from an elvish perspective. And it's very important to keep that in mind while you're reading any chapter of it, but particularly,
right.
you know, chapters that talk about races other than elves, like dwarves, like humans.
Right. Because Tolkien founded the found footage genre. You know, this idea that he's translating a book of history from
right.
this other universe. And so the Lord of the Rings is the translations of the Red Book and the writings of, you know, Bilbo and Frodo and Sam
mm-hmm.
eventually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he really liked the whole concept of frame narrative.
Mm-hmm. And here we have Noldor writings.
Exactly. Exactly. Although I'm sure that they spoke to some Teleri and some... oh, good Lord, I'm going to forget the other name.
Oh, the Vanyar?
Call me a Tolkien scholar. The Vanyar, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, the Noldor aren't known for being too open-minded, at least in their early days. But later on, they soften up. You know, Elrond's a pretty nice guy. Which is actually, it's funny, I played the Elrond quote up front. In the movies, he's pretty dark. He's pretty serious and not very joyful almost ever. You know, he raises an eyebrow at Pippin and Merry, but that's about it. In the books, he's much more, you know, it's the last homely house. Go to Elrond's and party hardy, you know?
Yeah,
let's
yeah.
go and have a great time.
Moreover, he's Aragorn's foster father.
Right.
Right. He loves him. I mean, it's very clear from the beginning. Aragorn, of course, in the books is not somebody who's lost his way in trying to find himself and come to terms with his ancestral history. He knows who he is, knows the role that he has right. to play, and has accepted that a long time ago. I think he would have done that even if Arwen hadn't been part of the equation.
Right.
Because I have a hard time picturing Arthur saying, well, you know, actually, I kind of like to give Excalibur back. If it's all right with you.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
Aragorn is the Arthurian figure in Lord of the Rings. So.
And I understand why Peter Jackson did it in the movie to give a narrative arc.
Yeah, narrative arc, whatever.
I know.
I think Aragorn had a plenty of a narrative arc in the series, in
right.
the books.
Well, we don't need to debate it tonight because we are backing up thousands upon thousands of years back to the First Age. The Valar have decided to take a hands-off approach in Middle-earth, except for Umbo, of course, sending messages men can only get the vibe of within the water. And the Noldor apparently are the only ones doing anything about Morgoth.
Well, at least that's what it looks like. The fact that there were no Valar that came to guide men in Hildorian or to summon them to dwell in Valinor resulted in the fact that humans just really didn't know about the Valar at all, or else they knew what little they learned from the so-called dark elves who never went to Valinor, never saw the light of the trees.
Right. The elves that trusted the Valar the least.
Right. Because, you know, why should we go? And to be perfectly honest, I think part of it too is that the Valar were kind of shocked by what happened in the outcome of, you know, after they quote unquote invited these elves to come to Valinor and be there. And, you know, look how that turned out for the Noldor at any rate. And
yeah.
Ulmo really was the only one who took thought for them and helped with councils. And, you know, he was the one who helped Tuor eventually save Gondolin and the father of Eärendil and all the rest of that. So,
spoilers.
Spoilers.
That's all right. There's not many spoilers in the Silmarillion. He kind of tells you up front what's going to happen.
Yes.
But, I mean, it's interesting to me that the Valar go through this cycle of action and inaction where they kind of let issues fester and eventually they have to go take a hand at it.
Well, I suppose if you're eternal beings, you know, time has a much a little different meaning to you.
Sure,
than it
sure.
Just to,
it's the Elrond Doran situation, right? Except it's infinite beings and beings that have the lifespan of Arda.
Yeah. But I find it interesting that in the cases of both the children of Iluvatar, the elves and the humans, they loved the water. So you have this sentence that, you know, Ulamo was sending messages to the humans through the waters. But as Tolkien wrote, they have not skill in such matters and still less had they in those days before they had mingled with the elves. Therefore, they loved the waters and their hearts were stirred, but they understood not the messages. And this takes us right back to the very first chapter of the Silmarillion, in which he wrote, "And it is said by the Eldar that in water there lives yet the echo of the music of the Ainur, more than in any other substance else that is in this earth. And many of the children of Iluvatar hearken still unsated to the voices of the sea, and yet know not for what they listen. That was the sentence the very first time I ever picked up this book in 1977 and felt rather bewildered. But I read that sentence and I said, okay, I know exactly what he's talking about. I'll just keep going because clearly he knows what he's talking about. There's something here. So all the children react to this sound, but some of them had more skill in the matter than others. And yet even the elves are listening still unsated and yet know not for what they're listening. So I don't know why they're making this massive distinction between the elves and the humans. Right. And in fact, I can't remember if Ulamul ever talks directly to an elf, but he does to a human.
Right, right. With Gondolin.
Yeah. Or I guess he does talk directly to Turgon.
Mm-hmm.
At some point.
He's just big on the Gondolin communications. This is the worldwide Gondolin web.
But to your point about the Valar seeming to, you know, have inaction for long periods of time, yes, it sounds that way. They sat behind their mountains at peace. They gave light to Middle Earth. And so, okay, fine. You got the light. You're on your own. So it really does sound as though they're brushing them off. But they do have their reasons. You know, they'd seen the assault upon the moon and the sun by Morgoth, and they feared what he might achieve. And so there, this time, there's enough of the children running around that they don't want to make a war upon Morgoth because they remembered, you know, the destruction that happened from that. But they also remembered, as it says, the ruin of Almaren, which was the island with the two lamps way back in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And they resolved that the like should not befall Valinor. And frankly, I don't see that that's all that different from what Turgon did with Gondolin.
Sure. But it's also like, just because my kids made a mess doesn't mean I have to make a mess, right?
Well, I think they're kind of caught. I mean, on the one hand, they do know that they're, call it invitation, call it interference, call it what you will, bringing all those elves over from Valinor, with the exception of the Vanyar, you could argue was not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so here come these humans who are clearly more frail, clearly have some kind of importance that they don't understand. Remember, they don't know anything much at all about Eru's plan for the children, because none of them, except a little bit of Manwë maybe and Melkor, had any sense of the children in their part of the song.
Yeah. I would say Mandos has some kind of idea as well.
Yeah. I mean, he knows where they head out to, presumably. But just like any parent, they didn't get a manual.
Right.
So they do the best they can. They make mistakes. They try to learn from the mistakes. And we can go around saying, well, how come they didn't just, you know, break down their walls and go and storm Morgoth and all the rest of it? Well, because the last time they did that, they destroyed a lot of the earth. And, you know, these humans just are not capable of dealing with that. Even the elves weren't capable of dealing with that very well.
So I'm going to push back a little bit.
Go.
The Valar in the Third Age make a big deal about, well, this ring is of Middle Earth, and therefore it must be destroyed by the peoples of Middle Earth. Well, this being is of the Ainur and should be destroyed by the Ainur, or contained or captured or put into the void by the Ainur. I don't really understand how they ever expected the children of Iluvatar to deal with Morgoth. It was not a realistic expectation.
Yeah. I don't know that they did expect it.
And that's why I call it inaction, right? It's not, I understand a little bit of caution, but how many eons is warranted of caution. And it's not like they took extra precautions once they finally did something. All they did was wait until it got so bad that there was no other choice.
All they did was wait until Rendil arrived.
Right.
I think there's a key there. I'm not sure that I can explicate it a lot, but there was some... I mean, let's face it. They had a right to be angry with the Noldor.
Sure.
You know, there was murder. The Noldor
aren't the only people living in Middle Earth either.
Well, no, they're not. And yet they're the most powerful people.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who are basically ruling the roost for the time being. And Thingol takes exception to that notion. But, you know, Doriath is the classic enclosed kingdom of the fairies, the fae. But right. The rest of it... pretty wide open. And oh, by the way, it's only Elrond's word that we have that the Valar will not take back the ring.
Okay.
You know, for better or for worse, it belongs to Middle Earth and we have to deal with it. That's, I mean, he's wise. I don't mean to imply otherwise. I just wonder where he got that information and why he feels that way about it all.
The Eagles stopped by and said, "Here, listen, here's your,
here's the here's deal your from intel. Manway.
Here's your intel.
Could be. And also, of course, we'd already seen Sauron destroyed once by the direct intervention of Iluvatar. And oh, by the way, that resulted in a lot of destruction of the land, and not just the island of Numenor, but also all the coasts up and down of Middle Earth. So maybe they're not acting because they're afraid of the damage they might do.
Yeah. It's a good question, and my case against Manway strengthens as the chapters go on.
Yeah, well, sometimes we need sometimes we need to blame somebody, and he's daddy, so.
Oh, I know. But no, I just mean, I think it's interesting to debate the leadership of the Valar, because they are the rulers of this world, for better or worse.
Well, but that's the thing, you see. That is one interpretation, and it's often placed that way. They were not, to my mind, the rulers of the earth. They were the shapers and the tenders and the demiurges. Their knowledge was about the stuff of the earth. They were intended to prepare it for the awakening of the children. And they had... You know, nobody had made any plans for Morgoth's writhing, as it were. And so he definitely introduced more than an element of chaos into things. So there was an extra factor that nobody had actually planned on. But they were not intended, I don't think, to be rulers. That was the job of Eru Iluvatar. And Tolkien's Catholicism would not let him depict Eru to any great degree. He's probably one of the most shadowy figures that we have after we get through the opening chapters of the Valaquenta. So, yeah, it'd be nice if they learned as they went along, you know, like good parents do, but they weren't supposed to be parents. They weren't supposed to be, you know, even in the primary world, I don't think Tolkien had a concept of God as a parent or a ruler in the sense we might think. And again, that's just my headcanon. Because we come to this stone or stumbling block or gift, whatever you want to call it, of free will. And an awful lot, it seems to me, of what the children are supposed to be learning is, what do I do with this?
Right.
Where does my right end and your right begin? You know, whose earth is it anyway? I think it's easy to see them as gods because they certainly mimic the pantheons that we're familiar with in the primary world, you know, the Greek and the Norse and all the rest of it. But it's a little more nuanced than that, and he never really dug into that too much because the story wasn't really about them.
Right.
And it's interesting to ask, you know, why didn't the elves up and say, yeah, we don't know why they all sat behind their walls and did nothing.
Yeah, that's true. They really don't complain about it. Even the Noldor, who are
right
Yeah, who are the biggest critics of the Valar.
Well, and I think they also, the Noldor, most of them recognize, okay, we really messed up.
Yeah.
You know, once Feanor is out of the picture, I think, you know, his older sons really did. Well, I mean, none of Maedhros says, no, I'm not going to be king.
Right, you know, right.
We're going to just
I'll save it for
ourselves.
For the future chapters for that one. Sure. Also, we're getting dangerously close to a discussion of The Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis, so we're going to have to move on from Catholicism for now.
Yes.
So let's talk about men awakening. So men awaken with the sun, which is super similar to how elves awaken with the stars.
Right.
I thought this was fascinating, and I kind of don't know what he's doing with this, except perhaps to signify as the days and years are accelerating that men are, you know, the shorter lived.
Yeah, that was that. A lot of that was interesting. It's almost as if, you know, once Yavanna's vegetation starts to grow, that's kind of yet another event which brings about more death, if you will. Because Middle Earth is not deathless. It's beautiful.
Right.
It's fantastic. It all these new things, they have a life cycle. And in Valinor, if you have the capacity to live there, you simply have, you know, eternal bliss. You have trees that don't die until they're killed.
Mm-hmm.
And plants and so forth. So there is this sense of, I think at some point he refers to the air gets heavier with mortality.
Yeah.
And I had posed this question, why would the years of the sun run swifter than the years of the two trees? And I think how I'd answer my own question is because the years of the sun are years of mortality. And they seem to go more quickly because you know there's going to be an end.
Right.
Whereas if you know you are in the realm of the eternal, there's no concern about, yep, this is going to end one day.
Right.
Because it will, but one day is unimaginably distant from here and now.
Right.
And the fact that the fact that the sun first arose in the west, and the opening eyes of men were turned toward it, and their feet, as they wandered over the earth, for the most part, strayed that way. I saw that as a really lovely secondary world explanation for why humans, at least on the east coast of the Atlantic, look to the west as a place of blessings, of ancestors, of great ones. And this is also, you have the legends of Shield Sheaf, which Tolkien was fascinated by. They first encountered in Beowulf, which of course we all know Tolkien loved. And there's a King Sheev legend, which was associated that with the Lost Road and the Notion Club papers. This is when the idea of Numenor was just beginning to percolate. And it's the traditions, as he wrote in a letter to Christopher Bretherton in 1964, the traditions of the North Sea. So it's not even all of the, you know, eastern coast. It's just the North Sea. Concerning the coming of corn and culture heroes, ancestors of kingly lines and boats, and their departure in funeral ships. So there again, association with funerals and you know, bereavement in the West. One such sheaf or shield chafing can actually be made out as one of the remote ancestors of our present queen. Now, I take that with lashings of salt. But this was very much in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
These were very important legends to him. And again, I think this is his way of hinting at why we have such a strong association with the West as being the place of heroes, the place of our ancestors.
Right. And of course, we've been, you know, mentioning this from time to time from the beginning, but Tolkien was also a man from the West who was born in a colonial state.
Yeah.
And there is an aspect of, you know, the whole West is best colonialist attitude. And I don't think he explicitly held it, but I think it's somewhere in his psyche.
That's interesting, John. I hadn't thought about that, but I think you're right. I think there may be more than a little influence about that too.
And again, I think Tolkien, it's really interesting because he's clearly a traditionalist and he clearly holds a lot of very traditional, socially conservative views, but I think he also was super empathetic. And yes. Those two things are a bit in conflict in his writing.
Well, certainly retrospectively, he knew his mother had been appalled by the things that she saw in the colonized area that was at that time called the Orange Free State, which eventually morphed into South Africa.
Right.
And he kind of took that on for his own. And then when he wrote letters to his son, Christopher, who was there in South Africa training with the RAF, he spoke about, you know, I'm not at all surprised that you find, you know, treatment of the native peoples appalling because, you know, my mother felt the same way. And yes, it really is appalling and so forth.
Right. Right. Something else I'm thinking of with the sun and moon, since we're veering off now, the sun and moon versus the stars is that the sun is up for a short while and then then gone, right?
Nice.
But nice. The stars remain in their places for eternity. Well, you know, stars burn out, but basically
eternally.
And they also
expand because the universe is expanding. But yeah, right, I get your basic point.
But they fade with the coming of the sun into invisibility, which is exactly what happens. We even hear in this chapter, which is exactly what happens to the bodies of elves.
Lovely, John. I really like that.
Now, you've got some other notes here about the dark elves as well.
Yes. The Noldor are the ones who come along and kind of trample through this. Tolkien writes, but the dawn is brief and the day full often belies its promise. You know, it may start off well, but sooner or later somebody's going to come along and throw a wrench in things. But this early, early time of the elves, there was little peril in the lands and the hills, and there new things devised long ages before in the thought of Yavanna, and sown as seed in the dark came at last to their budding and their bloom. West, north, and south, the children of men spread and wandered, and their joy was the joy of the morning before the dew is dry, when every leaf is green. Gosh, that sounds like Eden to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the closest that Tolkien could come to saying, you know, this is my secondary world's version of Eden. He wrote in a letter, I think again to Christopher, that there definitely had been an Eden on this unhappy world. So he held that belief quite firmly. So it's not surprising to me that it would show up in his Legendarium in some fashion. And I think
Eden,
this
to me, has always been something that we all seek. You know, we all seek that peace. And Tolkien, whose early life was filled with such turmoil and pain, must have wanted to believe that this place existed.
Yeah. I think it also gets associated with innocence.
You know, which he lost very early.
Exactly. You know, prior to the knowledge of good and evil, so to speak, the time before they started to encounter Morgoth and his lies, and even, you know, the returning of the Noldor brought with it pain and suffering and destruction.
Yeah.
So.
And of course, we learn in this passage, in this section, that things are going to be good for a while, but this story does a lot of foreshadowing, right? This writing does a lot of foreshadowing. Tolkien basically says, yeah, so the Noldor are going to turn this completely upside down with their nonsense.
Yeah,
this isn't going to last.
I don't think they were as allergic to spoilers in his time as we seem to be now.
No, I know. Everything today has to be sealed in a vault until the minute that you're ready. We once got feedback admonishing us for spoiling a 60-year-old book.
No.
I was like, you've had your opportunity. You've had your opportunity.
if you're listening to us now, presumably you know something about it.
Anyway, fun times. Marilyn, any more points about the Noldor's nonsense before we take a quick break?
Well, it's pretty nonsensical. It's the dangers of possessiveness, which was one of Tolkien's favorite themes. It's pride, it's arrogance, and it's the danger of oaths. Particularly oaths that are taken upon the name of the Valar.
Especially overbroad oaths, neither men nor demon nor Vala, you know, everybody. I'm going to mess you all up, Feanor says.
Yeah, I don't care who you are. You know, those are my Silmarils, and if you try to keep them from me. But the really tragic thing is that he also laid this oath upon his sons. Not only the time that they jumped up and swore it beside him when he first made it, but here's Feanor on his death rock, if you will, because he wasn't in bed. He was in one of the hills looking out at what Morgoth had built for his own palace and saw with his own eyes that their quest was impossible.
Yep.
And yet he laid it upon his sons to keep the oath. And you want to talk about bad parenting.
Yep.
I mean, you know, the Valar are nothing compared to Feanor. I'm sorry. For being a really bad father.
It's true. I'm not sure Finwë was the best dad either, to be honest. But
No, but that's then to get into the whole discussion of marriage and divorce and
Yep. I don't think the marriage and divorce was the problem. I think his governance of his house surrounding it was the problem.
Yeah. I mean, how do we handle our grief, right?
Yeah.
He was very much a grieving husband. And it's very hard to give children what they need and want when you yourself are so deeply wounded.
Right. All right, Marilyn, let's take a quick break. When we get back, we will talk about some details of men.
Sounds good.
So we get some details about men in the latter part of this. It's so we get this whole idea that they're close to elves in these days, just a little bit lesser. This Caliquendi, Moriquendi men scale, the ladder of evolution, right? You know the evolution of man charts where it's like, you know, they start off as a caveman and they end up crouching over a computer. That's what we're looking at here. And I'm throwing around a lot of words, but Caliquendi is just the light elves, the elves you saw, the light of the trees of Valinor. Moriquendi is the dark elves, those who did not see the light of Valinor, whether they wanted to or not. Mm-hmm. And men are men.
Who don't even know that the two trees ever existed or that the Valar do exist.
Right.
Yeah, so Tolkien, again, Tolkien loved him his hierarchies.
Yeah.
And that's what we got here. But it is kind of interesting that they started off as being, you know, more equal than they eventually wind up or are portrayed as winding up. And it kind of makes me wonder, so if they're so much weaker and, you know, sickly and all the charming names that the Lord developed for the human race.
The Uggos.
But what I want to know is how did they manage to overcome the elves if they're so weak and pathetic and all the kinds of things that
Good
we're
question.
Describing here? And, you know, you could just say, well, it's because that's how it was. And the sort of overarching knowledge that this is how they were created, that the elves are going to fade and... You know, right now with an old order running around and the Sindar keeping hidden, it's like it's hard to recognize that because they are presented as being so much superior. Now, is that because these stories are told by the Noldor, I wonder?
Mm-hmm.
But again,
there's also, I mean, like, the tigers are a lot stronger than us if we had to fight them one-on-one. But we spread out a lot more. And also, I think you have the aspect of, like you kind of alluded to it, but the elves voluntarily leaving Middle-earth at certain times, right? Which is that they... I think that the elves, other than the Noldor and only certain Noldor, didn't really desire to have a permanent domain on Middle-earth. This was always going to be a passing semblance here.
That's an interesting question. The ones who never do go, the Mordekwendi, the Dark Elves, it seems to me that they have just said, look, we love this earth. We don't want to leave it. And in the end, they don't leave it.
Right. But they will fade anyway.
Their bodies fade, but their souls, their spirits remain.
Right.
And they're not interested in power and domination and all that sort of thing. So in a sense, that saves them. But the more the elves were putting out in terms of fighting battles and trying to overcome Morgoth and, by the way, doing pretty nasty things too, the more their physical essence is consumed by their spiritual essence. And I don't know if that would have been the same thing for the men, because the men don't hang around long enough to find out, you know?
Right.
And so maybe the fact that men were more vulnerable and sickly and aged and all the rest of it was sort of a balancing factor against the elves. It, particularly if they both started off with the same level of stature and strength and so forth.
Right. It's interesting because he says, oh, they are like stature and strength, but the elves are just way better. And we have this hierarchy put into place, Caliquendi, Moriquendi men. First of all, quick question. Do you think we're seeing the Moriquendi, the dark elves, in Rings of Power?
I think we're seeing Sylvan elves.
Okay.
I have yet to see anything that I would equate with Moriquendi, because I don't see Moriquendi acknowledging Gil-galad as High King.
Oh, I mean, you know, as we have the stranger running off into the east, into Rune. Do you think that we're finally going to see some dark elves on screen?
Interesting question. It's really important for me to remember that Dark Elf does not have anything to do with their morality. It's strictly whether or not they saw the light or even wanted to go to see it.
Right.
I don't think we can say there's anything innately evil for saying, nah, thanks, I'm good here.
No. I don't think there's anything innately evil. It's about, were they imbued with this sort of superpower? Were they supercharged by this light of the trees with wisdom, with some extra strength, with this holy light?
I think so. And also with association with the Valar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have Noldor studying with Aule. So they have greatly increased skills in smithcraft and so forth. And some of them with Yavanna. So they have the ability to make things grow and blossom. And so on and so on. So it's a combination of factors.
And we'll cover this part that I'm about to talk about when we get to Of the Coming of Men into the West. But the early men have a similar experience with the elves, right? They are wiser than their kindred because they befriend certain Noldor factions.
And I think there's also an element of... they are fleeing from a darkness, which is in their distant past, that they do not wish to go back to. And they have heard rumors, presumably from Moriquendi elves, that there is light and goodness in the West.
Mm.
And so they travel, you know, incomprehensible distances to get away from the darkness, which is behind them, and get to the light, which they've heard of. The only problem is they cross the Blue Mountains and they come into Beleriand, and suddenly they find, oh, actually, we just walked right into the evil, because, by the way, over a couple of forests and streams and whatever is the home of the evil itself.
Right.
And there's wars and battles and conflicts and so on. So.
Right.
But at least the implication is they left for the right reasons and they were seeking the right things. And that, I think, was part of what gave them more stature.
Right.
And they loved the elves, and pledged their service to them.
Right. They came as friends, right? Thing. They came to be
they
friends.
They became friends, certainly. They became friends. They came seeking goodness, however they were defining that. And because the first elf they ever encountered was Finrod Felagund, well, you know, that was a real good introduction to the very best of elvish nature.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, they did figure out, okay, well, you know, he's kind of an exemplar. Just like humans, you know, there's a full range of elvish behavior. And
Shmirneas Smarnordiad. That's a deep cut joke. If you know that one, great. If not, don't worry about it.
He might even remember by the time they come to that particular chapter.
Right, right. All right. So,
at that point.
So men are mortal. We know that because we are we are the race of humans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big departure from the elves who are going to live forever. And not only that, we have this big gaping difference, which is when the elves die, they just teleport on back to the Valinor and the, you know, the halls of Mandos. Their spirit does, at least they can be restored in body many times, you know, by the will of Valar. But men, they might hang out with Mandos for a minute, but that's not the final stop. And nobody knows what that final stop is except Mandos.
Right. Right. And he ain't telling. And this whole thing is the heart and the basis and the seed of so many stories in the Legendarium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the coming together of elf and human, you know, so the first instance, of course, Beren and Lúthien. And then you have Tuor and Idril, and you have the quote-unquote creation of the half-elven, which is a term that is applied with such scorn by some people in the Rings of Power series. I don't see why. I mean, you can get the best of both worlds, right?
Yeah. I understand the idea of, like, you know, if this special thing happens too many extra times, like if they added 10 more elf human couples, I think that would start to dilute the specialness of the ones that we have, but it's one more. I don't think it's that big of a deal.
No. Well, and the one more is probably, down in the southern regions of Gondor, where you have Prince Imrahil. I always find it so fascinating that, the proof that he has elven blood way back is that he doesn't have a beard. Now, cast your mind back to Peter Jackson's casting and all the humans who come from an elvish line who have beards. And you're like, well, okay.
Right.
Moving on.
Right. Well, and you also have, I mean, I think a lot of the people who make the argument like, oh, they're just trying to copy Elrond and Aragorn or Beren and Lúthien. A lot of them don't even know about Tuor and Idril.
That's right. That's right.
And they just don't want to, they don't even talk about it, right?
Right. And then Imrahil's ancestors, whoever they were. And for Tolkien, the reason why it was such a massive and crucial thing is this was his way of making sure that some small aspect of elves would remain forever in certain very, very important humans. So the ennoblement of humanity was this goal. And I find that an interesting concept in and of itself. Again, this is sort of Tolkien's whole interest in what he called blood, which I find more than a little troubling.
Sure.
But again, it's an aspect of his culture and his time. A lot of ideas about evolution and different quote-unquote races and things got changed pretty quickly after Hitler started rampaging through Europe. And the scholars of anthropology and sociology and so forth began to revise their theories pretty quickly. But it is the heroic tradition that the hero is the child of a god. And so this, again, I think is Tolkien's way of bringing in that concept. You know, you have the demigods who were the children of Zeus or whoever, bringing that divine nature into human beings in a small way, perhaps, And here we have the elves standing in for that, I think.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be fun if when you did 23andMe, it said you're this percent Neanderthal and this percent elf?
Well, by recent scholarship, I think the Neanderthals are you know, pretty good people to draw your ancestry from.
There you go.
Yeah. And of course, this is one of the benefits of reading the Silmarillion is you can see in this discussion the seeds for Arwen and Aragorn.
Right.
And the tie back to the mythologies and the very, very ancient histories. Mm-hmm. So what Tolkien says is the fate of men after death maybe is not in the hands of the Valar, nor was all foretold in the music of the Ainur. And so there you have the setup for we don't know what happens to men after they die, or and women and non-binary and you know, humans. And the wonderful tale in the appendices of Arwen and Aragorn. Arwen says, you know, I say to you, King of the Numenoreans, not till now have I understood the tale of your people and their fall. As wicked fools, I scorn them, but I pity them at last. For if this is indeed, as the Eldar say, the gift of the one to men, it is bitter to receive.
Right.
She's living it now. And some understanding can only happen experientially. And Aragorn replies and says, so it seems, but let us not be overthrown at the final test, who of old renounced the shadow and the ring. In sorrow we must go, but not in despair. Behold, we are not bound forever to the circles of the world, and beyond them is more than memory. Farewell. Mm. You can see why he was named Estel, which means hope.
Yeah.
That was his first name. And again, we get the reminder of the difference between fear or sorrow and despair, mm-hmm. or even hope and despair. This notion that at the end of the day, we have to trust. Trust what we know or think we know or have experienced of what we might call loving God or grace or the beauty of the world. And that it doesn't just end with life. Now, I know everybody doesn't believe that. That's fine. But this is Tolkien's own statement.
Right.
Death is bitter to receive. And yet that doesn't mean that we can't go with hope.
Right. We talked a lot before about how the elves consume their bodies with their spirits. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm going to skip over that.
Okay.
But I do want to talk about, on the note of hope, Beren and Eärendil, the teases of them towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
Beren, of course, being the only man to ever come back from death. That's plugged in this chapter. And then Eärendil is the one who's going to provide hope for both men and elves.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Yes. And again, this seems to be one of the reasons why the Valar wait so long to intervene. Because this is the anticipated and expected and intended outcome. That we will have an offspring of both humans and elves to come and plead for both races. Again, I don't like the word race, but that's the one he uses. And that this glory and beauty of the elves and their fate is to be shared fully with the offspring of Elf and Mortal, Eärendil and Elwing and Elrond their child. So again, the ennoblement of humans.
I like it a lot. I think it's a great note to end on. Marilyn, this was actually a very fun chapter to talk about with you because going into it, I thought, I don't know what I'm going to talk about for so long about this chapter that's really just a couple of pages.
Mm-hmm.
But You've pulled a lot of great stuff out of it, and I really appreciate that you were the one who came on this one.
Well, thank you. I really appreciated being invited to do so, and the longer you live with Tolkien, the more there is to
right.
connect. So
right.
I have the benefit of, you know, long years of having him be on my bookshelf.
Right. Well, if you, listener, want to talk Tolkien with us, you can write into lotr@thelorehounds.com. You can go to the contact page on our website, thelorehounds.com, or you can head onto our Discord. There's a Tolkien Talk channel. You can tag us. You can, if you write a thoughtful comment and you don't tag us, we might pull it anyway, just so beware. Beware. But if you aren't a fan of writing in and you still want to hear more Tolkien Talk, you should, of course, tune into Rings and Rituals, Marilyn's podcast. I'm caught up now, and
oh, good!
My God, is it good?
I was listening to it
the other morning while I was just getting the kids ready, and it's just such a peaceful morning listen. And I hope people will check it out because I'm really proud that we're hosting it on our network. I think it's really high quality stuff, and I think it deserves a bigger audience.
Well, I'm so grateful to you for giving us the platform and all the support. And, you know, there we are in the Discord channels and having lots of wonderful conversations with people. And in some respects, I wish we could come out every week because I think people like that flow and the continuity and so forth. But given my schedule and in particular, given Sarah's schedule,
mm-hmm.
we had to give ourselves some leeway.
Right. Right.
And that also means that our feedback is not consonant with our recordings. And I hope that's not too irritating for people. You get used to the pattern of the weekly podcast. And so
right,
you can
right.
talk about stuff from the previous episode and feedback and all the rest of it. But I hope that since, you know, the program has been around for a while now, anyway, it won't matter quite as much that, you know, we have that kind of
I think it's a good cadence
schedule.
I think it's a good cadence. So please go check that out. That link's in the show notes. We have some other affiliates too. We just launched Radioactive Ramblings, a Fallout podcast, which is Aaron and Chase. They are, you might recognize Aaron as Aaron K from our Discord. He's one of the mods, one of the Dunedain.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a really great guy. His friend Chase is a really great guy. They are covering the new Fallout show on Amazon Prime. It's getting rave reviews, and their download numbers are up too, so it must have a big audience. And so they are doing a great job covering it. They already have episodes 1 through 6 covered on their feed, so you can go there now for most of the season. They're going to do another podcast on episodes 7 and 8 coming soon. Looks like late this week. And then they're going to be doing a final season wrap up and listener feedback episode. So definitely check out their feed to find out how you can write into them.
Mm-hmm.
Wool Shift Dust is back. They're doing Beacon 23 on Alicia's feed. She already did an interview with author Hugh Howey.
That's so exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that she's I poked fun at her the other day on our Shogun podcast because she's been subbing for me on a lot of the Shogun podcast because of my mother's illness
right.
and I was out right. and I said, "Hi, I'm Alicia. I know Hugh Howey." And so I hope she's not too offended if she listens to that one. But so it's great stuff. I know she's got some Dune stuff planned too, so stick around over there. Properly Howard Movie Review is back. They are reviewing movies and deciding if they are better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard film. Their current season is Felonies and Fugazis, and they've already covered Point Break. You can find that on their feed now. Shakedown is their next one. Then they're doing Tango and Cash, Pulp Fiction, Gross Point Blank, and Rocky. So plenty of great content ahead. It's really funny. I already listened to some of the Point Break one, and I haven't even seen the movie, and it's a good time. So got to check it out.
So for the sake of listeners like myself who really don't know what a Fugazi is, can you fill us in a little?
Fugazis.
Or leave it to them to explain.
Fugazi, it means effed up in slang. an effed up situation, it looks like.
Gotcha.
It's Tolkien, so I feel the need to be a little cleaner than our explicit rating. I don't know. I just feel like the professor is watching me.
So felonies and verklempness.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. And of course, we'll be joining Anthony and Steve to cover Severance Season 2 once that's out. That's in a separate feed as well, so that check the show notes for that. For the Lorehounds, we're finishing up Shogun. We've got a couple episodes left. One's probably out, actually, like today. And we are covering it basically with Alicia at this point, because she's been in for so much of the season. I'm going to be on the podcast with David for episodes 9 and 10, and then all three of us are going to do a season wrap. We're also going to have a special guest, Nate, on the Discord. He's a PhD candidate and a member of the East Asian Studies faculty at Princeton. So,
terrific.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really excited to chat with him. He's always got great stuff to say in the Shogun channels. He knows a ton about this stuff.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's really great about the Discord, is that you do get people there who, you know, they are of Japanese, you know, descent,
or they
studied it for their livelihood and so on. And so you can get some marvelous insights into these things.
Right. I mean, we got Brian 8063 with White House Plumbers and a bunch of other projects, and you've got Nate here on Japanese history. It's incredible. I can't believe the people who cop into the Discord. We've got a bunch of other stuff coming. There was a Monkey Man one shot with Alicia and David. There's a Star Wars Film Festival coming back with A New Hope this month.
Yay.
We just put out a Lorehounds play about Halo, and that one has me, Brandon, and John. So he came in to talk about Halo. I know David's got a couple one shots planned with Ron Dawson, Three Body Problem and Civil War. And I think John's on that one too. And you're going to do one on Dick Turpin with him.
That's right. We are busily crafting that one. And I think it's going to be fun. If you haven't seen that series and you really want some lightheartedness in your life, I can highly recommend Dick Turpin, the completely made up adventures of Dick Turpin, which is on Apple Plus.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
It is. It is.
I lastly want to plug, because I think you'll like it if you like the Silmarillion. We're still going through Earthsea. We're finally back with it. Marilyn, Yay. You and I are going to be recording the podcast tomorrow night, so it should be up 2 or 3 days after this Silmarillion Stories episode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that'll be a lot of fun. We're covering Dragonfly, just the short story Dragonfly right now.
Yes.
Plenty of stuff coming in the summer. We've got Doctor Who, The Acolyte, The Boys, The Bear, Severance, Rings of Power sometime. And House of the Dragon is going to be our big June show starting June 16th.
Uh-huh.
David and I actually just had a conversation. We're going to be doing a season one rewatch podcast in the weeks leading up to House of the Dragon. That's going to be our big weekly coverage after Shogun.
Hmm.
So we're going to have a good time with it.
By the way, I meant to say I have not watched Monkey Man. I don't think I ever will watch Monkey Man, but I really enjoyed the podcast. So,
oh, good.
I
listened to some of it. It sounds like a fun movie. It sounds like a movie I would like.
Uh-huh.
It's always fun. I do enjoy listening to podcasts where I didn't consume the media sometimes. It's fun to get the people's impressions.
Yeah. No, it works. It works.
All right. Quick plug on our Patreon. It's a great place. You get early and ad-free access to our content. You get Shireside Chats. You get Second Breakfast. You get access to polls where we talk about what movie we're going to cover on Second Breakfast for our old man movie or our millennial madness movie, whatever David calls my lists. And you get to just be a part of the community and help us, you know, fund these efforts to make more podcasts, to bring on more additional feeds. You know, it's great when somebody like Aaron approaches us, or someone like Marilyn approaches us and says, hey, can we host the feed here? Sure, that sounds great. We have resources here. So please consider joining us on the Patreon. I want to thank our Discord server boosters, Opus and the Machine, Gnarls, Aaron K, Tiller the Thriller, Dork of the Ninjas, and Doove71. And also our Patreon lore masters, our top tier subscribers who put the G in generosity. Samartian, Mark H, Michael G, Michelle E, David W, Brian P, Nick W, SC, Peter OH, Bettina W, Adam S, Nancy M, 271, Brian 8063, Frederick H, Sarah L, Gareth C, Eric F, Matthew M, Sarah M, DJ Miwa, Andre B, Kwang Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T, Alex V, Aaron T, Sub Zero, Aaron K, Dally V21, Mothership 61, our newest lore master, Gnarls, and Adrian. Always last, but never least. Thanks, everyone.
You're getting very good at Gnarls.
Oh, thank you. I've been practicing. Every podcast I practice.
I can tell.
Anyway, thank you to our lore masters. Thank you to all our patrons and Supercast subscribers. It really helps us keep things going. And thanks to you, listener, for being here on our journey through the Silmarillion. Marilyn, yes. I'll talk to you on Earthsea.
Sounds like a plan.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.